Welcome to Still Untitled, the Adam Savage Project. I'm Will.
I'm Adam.
And I'm Norm.
Sorry about that. I was texting.
Bad form. Okay, so before we even start, I'm going to warn people that upstairs, there are people doing real work.
Yes.
They're adding lights to your attic. Not a euphemism.
My loft space is getting some fluorescent light to become a more viable storage place. And we'll take a tour up there at some point.
I've never been up there.
No, I know. Will went up for the first time today, which is took your life in your hands.
It's about low ceiling.
Yeah, it's about 62-inch clearance. So yeah. I bump my head every other time I'm there.
And I'm roughly 74 inches.
Attics in houses are typically the cool places. When you're a kid to go, like you'd find, discover amazing things in there. And a lot of houses don't have attics these days, just like they don't have basements. So you got to imagine, for a place already this cool, the attic upstairs, maybe like some treasures up there.
There's some treasures up there, to be sure.
Yeah.
And I grew up with two amazing attics. My grandmother had a pair of crawl spaces, again, not a euphemism, in her house in Sneeden's Landing, New York. And my parents had also...
So when you say crawl spaces, you mean below the house?
No. Oh, okay. I mean, actually, way up in... They had this really weird, rambling house that was built by an architect who I think was a grateful patient of my grandfather's. And there was, a guest bedroom where they had crawl spaces to either side under the eaves of the house. So it was like, you had to, make sure you stayed on the studs because you could fall through the ceiling.
And probably the nails from the shingles are sticking through if you had shingles.
And I just totally remember in that, both that and my parents had a similar crawl space in the top floor of the house I grew up in. I just remember spending hours in the dark there with a flashlight going through stuff like, my mom's ex-husband's telegraph manuals. Because he was like a telegrapher as a hobby.
In addition to having written
most of the episodes of Kojak, my mom's ex-husband was also a telegraph enthusiast.
This is a conversation for another day. My dad lived in the attic when he was a kid. So he had like his room in this rambling split-level farmhouse was upstairs. So there was only a space about 3 feet wide in the middle that he could actually stand up in by the time he was like 12.
Like Greg Brady's room.
Kind of like Greg Brady's room, yeah. But it was all dormer edges, and you went out to the edge and there were...
I watched that show.
No, I liked watching it dawn on your...
But there were dozens of years of National Geos up there. So,
If anyone with the attic and kids.
Yeah, that'll do it.
Yeah.
You should always install like miniature houses. I also had National Geographic. I respect the yellow magazine. Build doll houses or small miniature houses or miniature furniture around, and kids would love that. It's perfect for imagination.
It is a long unfinished project. I have around here somewhere a set of 1/24 scale blueprints of the house that I grew up in, I would like to build a half. So dollhouse is 1/12 scale.
Okay, that's standard.
That is standard. That is 1 inch equals 1 foot. So a human would be 6 inches tall. Dollhouse scale for a real house is giant. Most dollhouses are actually quite small houses when you think about the size of your average house.
Right, otherwise it would fill a room.
Right. So, for instance, a standard like 20 by 40 foot lot would, in dollhouse scale, would be, almost 4 feet long and 2.5
feet
wide.
Well, 1 foot equals 1 inch.
It's
really
giant.
Straightforward, yeah.
So I would go half scale to that, 1/24 scale, where a human would be 3 inches tall. And the house I grew up in would be... A really substantial model, but it's something I want to do. My mom sold the house I grew up in a few years ago because it's just too big to maintain.
Should do Kenner figure scale.
Yeah, that's Kenner figure scale, three inch tall,
right?
Or are they 4 inches tall?
No, I think they're three.
Three and a half.
I've got some around here somewhere.
Why am I not surprised?
Well, if we're talking about things that are scaled big and small.
Oh, wow.
That was a terrible segue.
Well, shameful, Chan.
We're going to talk about Pacific Rim.
That's right. That was our point.
That's what we're here for.
Well done.
We haven't talked about it. It's been out for a couple of weeks.
Let's talk about Pacific Rim. Yeah.
And you wrote a review for the site when the movie first came out. We've had time to digest it. You've seen it twice now.
I've seen it actually 3 times.
Wow.
Yeah. Ooh. And... because I know Guillermo, he invited us to the premiere, so we went to see the premiere in LA, which was very exciting. then he insisted that I take the boys to see it in 3D IMAX. So nice. I did. And this is one of those movies. Go see it on the biggest screen you can get
to. So the way to watch it.
Just to be clear, it's post-enhanced 3D, but they did a much better job of it than I've ever seen with the post-enhanced 3D before. So he didn't shoot it in 3D. It was done in post. I saw it in IMAX. It was awesome.
It is really, really beautiful, isn't it? Yeah. And the 3D isn't overbearing. Sorry, that's the electrician.
I told you that people are working upstairs, yes, right?
That is the electrician. Don't worry about it, everyone. Sorry about the extra noise.
It's Adam's fault.
So, yeah, it is. And I've read a bunch of reviews of it. I've read a bunch of different people's takes on it. And it seems like that people's take run the gamut. But
I haven't seen a movie this widely reviewed in a while.
Yeah, you know, there are some people like, what a ridiculous, stupid movie. But for the most part, it seems to me, I mean, and...
Just to be clear, I came out and said, what a ridiculous, stupid movie!
Well, I mean, I'm called back to a memory I had at a cocktail party years and years ago. Con Air had just come out. I went to see it and enjoyed the spit out of it.
Yeah.
Con Air is inexorably what it is.
This is Wesley Snipes and...
This is Nicolas Cage, okay. Steve Buscemi, John...
I'm thinking of Passenger.
It's a Bruckheimer film.
Yeah, it's a Bruckheimer film. Okay. So, John Malkovich. It's a great movie.
The plane crashes in Vegas.
Right.
Money flies everywhere. Right. And there's a good behind-the-scenes prop story behind that. The prop company who made the money for that, because of the explosion scene, the money goes everywhere, people picked up that money and used in casinos, and they got banned for making fake money. Like, they can't do it anymore.
We should do an article about this, because there are some fairly impressive restrictions on makers of money in films. And you will notice, well, there is one design that's been used for the last few dozen years.
It's like official funny money.
And it's accurate enough that it has been successfully passed many, many times, and the Secret Service does not like that. So film money undergoes a lot of restrictions.
This is related, and it's a teaser for a video that we have coming up untested in a couple of weeks. But we visited a prop place on our way down to Comic-Con.
Right.
And they had a room that had a vault behind like bars of just stacks of it must have been several hundred million dollars in fake money wrapped in perfect, and it was just like
the back of an armored car, not like duffel bags.
That's
it was amazing.
Awesome. Con Air, back to this. Con Air just come out.
So we're in a segue for it. Yeah. We're in a segue to a segue.
Yeah. I am at a cocktail party, and there's a guy there going, Con Air. No, again, I remind you, it had just come out like 3 days before. What a piece of shit that movie was. God, I hated it. And it occurred to me, and I asked, you have to tell me what you were expecting.
Yeah.
Because I got precisely what I paid my $10 for. Con Air was exactly as advertised. And Pacific Rim is exactly as advertised. It is a genre film. The plot is an arrow. And it is just a beautiful ride. I've loved it each time that I've seen it. You know, I love that Guillermo writes strong female characters. Mako is a terrific character.
Mm-hmm. And great casting.
But it's not like the trailers for this movie depicted a touching love story and a tale of personal growth and development over a tragic setting of a war against some sort of undisclosed monsters. This is a movie about giant robots beating the shit out of giant monsters.
Yes, yes.
In interesting ways.
Yeah, totally interesting ways. The boat. The boat is such a great bit.
When he picks up
the boat and uses it as a club.
Physics be damned.
It's the reason the same thing.
You love movies like Independence Day and Starship Troopers and stuff like that. And, you know, Starship Troopers is more akin to this movie in terms of it being, it's going to be a cult hit.
Right, right. I also point out that, I lost the thread.
Cult hit?
The boat.
Oh, right. Sorry. Is that unlike, let's say, a Michael Bay film, Guillermo doesn't abandon you during the action sequences. And I mean this. Michael Bay's films, and it's terrifically used in a movie like The Rock, where in the action sequence, things are cutting so fast and furious that you kind of lose track of where you are. Now, I would defend The Rock as just one of the best.
I think The Rock is the perfect action movie.
It is a totally perfect action movie. It's a wonderful movie.
It's a Ferrari. There's things blow up.
Yeah.
There's a guy with green smoke.
It's what super quotable.
American flags.
No, I just caught it about a month ago on cable, like the second half in hotel room, and it's stunning.
LA makes a great fake San Francisco.
It totally does.
Yeah.
But I will point out that on the Transformer films, during some of the fight scenes, you have no idea where you are or what the hell's going on.
Which is so surprising because in Transformers 2, which is the worst culprit of that, all they had was time to write the fight scenes because it was during the writer's strike and they couldn't write the script. And so all they could do was choreograph fight scenes.
But I think is that part of that is because as an older viewer is like, if I was 10 years old when Transformers came out, I would have watched that movie 24 times on DVD, and I would be intimately familiar with those characters, and I would be able to look at the robots, and I'd see an elbow joint and know, that's got to be Ironhide. And I think that, like, that's a thing that, as people who, I hope you only watch Transformers maybe twice at most, like, we're outside the audience for that. I think we lose that.
It could be
because I don't have a connection with the robots.
I still think of it as a really crucial, and to me, it's a sign of a great director that I'm never abandoned in the physical space, even in small scenes, even in rooms. There are some directors who just don't know how to tell you where you are in the room, and you cutting back to a reverse angle, you're like, what is that shot?
And the rooms in Pacific Rim were pretty great. Like Idris Elba's room with just like, for some reason, a sunset right behind
him. The sunset behind it and the stream running through. I enjoyed the spit out of it. I love the monsters. I love the glowing roar, the advance of their weaponry.
Well, the bioluminescent stuff, like very clearly these are monsters that came from the bottom of the ocean, even if they came from some parallel dimension or through some sort of horrible wormhole or something like that. Like these are deep sea monsters. It's funny because it made me think of the sequence in episode one when they go through the center of Naboo.
Right.
And it's like, to me, that was my least favorite part of that movie, which I know is, you know, I don't mean to dig up old stuff.
That's a high bar, by the way, the least favorite part of episode one.
But those monsters didn't feel real. It felt like, we need to have the joke about there's always a bigger fish, and we got to have a small fish and a medium fish and a big fish.
Right.
And these all felt real, and they did a really good job with the scale. So you knew when that, this is going to be a spoiler cast.
Spoilers. You put that on the title.
I'll put it in the title again,
You know, and you're totally right. I will say in IMAX, one of the things that you get to see really clearly, and I think the guys from ILM are all quite proud of this, and they should be, is the water pouring off the bots. When the hands come together like that, and you watch the rain splatter off in scale, it is stunning in IMAX.
And you mentioned that when he does that, like that move, that is a perfect example of something that's impractical. A giant robot should never do that. The fact, there's this awesome, fist bumping yourself kind of thing.
Why should the giant robot never do that?
Well, you've also read about how in order for that giant robot to move like that, his arms are moving at like 350 miles an hour.
Of course,
Yeah. One of our friends said, it was a missed opportunity. The robot should have high-fived or fist bumped after beating up a monster together. That would have been a big,
hoorah
moment.
I also really, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, in terms of the creature design, when they're designing the monsters, because you only see four or five monsters, but they designed hundreds of them in preparation for the movie, and they had like an internal battle royale where they, chose two. And
they had drawings on the sketchboard, and they're like, do you like this one or this one better?
Wow.
Right.
That's awesome.
And so there is, I presume in the art book, dozens more creations, and eventually they got to the ones that were representative of the characterizations they wanted. But just as a creature designer, I'm sure the people working on it, it must have been one of the best jobs in the world.
So did ILM do both the robots and the creatures, or just the creatures?
That is not a question I know the answer to.
Okay, because I know that
they did the robots.
I know that Legacy did the suits, the armor for the pilots.
The exosuits.
And
a bunch of props. I know that Mike Azaldi over at Spectral Motion did things like the ticks that were on the those moving ticks and stuff like that, and a bunch of other stuff.
Fleas, yeah.
Yeah. A film like this probably reached out to half a dozen effects companies to do finishing work and stuff like that. But
those calling ticks, what a great little concept that they have parasites. And a great, like, let's not do what Godzilla 1998 Roland Emmerich Godzilla did when have, she's pregnant, and then have like the Jurassic Park, you know.
Well, Cloverfield did that too, just to be clear.
Oh, did it really? Oh, right.
Yeah, because Cloverfield the came had off all the things. Subways. Yeah.
I also loved. There's a scene where Mako and Charlie Hunnam are talking, and in the background, Gypsy Danger, it's a great name, is having its chest reattached, and you see the backside of it. From an engineering perspective, they really worked hard to create a narrative of construction and design on the thing that would hold up to some scrutiny.
Well, they felt like real things that would actually work in the real world, even though there's... you know, a 120-foot tall robot is probably impractical.
Right, but I mean, they put them on gantries that are similar to what they transport the space shuttle on and the Jupiter rockets on.
People are like looking at the helicopters that would drop them. Oh, the load capacity of that helicopter is 100 tons.
Right? Yeah, exactly.
You need X number to actually carry that. And, you know, they did some math.
If you're doing math, I'd say, you're thinking, look, it is an absolutely stunning ride. It's my favorite movie of the summer.
So then to loop back around, there was a lot of nitpicking. Like it was a film that critics came out and were like, well, you know, blah, 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 didn't have character development. Why were they building the wall? Blah, blah. You know, there was a lot of stuff, as with any giant action movie that hundreds of people touch. There's some stuff that doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Like, why are they building the big walls when the monsters can mow through them and... let's say 30 minutes.
They discovered that during the course of the film,
I suppose.
And you know, it's kind of a little bit of a satire. The bureaucracy. I love that when the program gets shut down, the Canadian guy is the last word. He's like, "No, we will build our wall."
Yeah. Well, and also Guillermo is very specific about not wanting it to be a military film. So the guy in charge, Idris Elba's character, isn't a general. He's a marshal. Mm-hmm. That he really sought to stay away from the militarization of the defenses.
I love that each of the. I mean, I wish that the Russian robot and the Asian one, the Chinese one, robot. had more screen time
And I love the design of those. I love the idea that triplets could control three arms.
Right. Yeah. And the Russian one was like very like heavy and built, and that one was sturdy and had this headbutt.
Yeah.
And they're just creative, like emblematic of the cultures they came from. They had the U.S. one in the montage in the beginning. It was like a boxer.
Yeah.
So was Gypsy Danger the Canadian one, or was it another American one?
I think it was another American one.
It was an earlier model of the American one, right?
So, yeah, when I was when I visited Guillermo on the set in January of 2012, I got a tour of the armor trailer by Shane Mann from Legacy Effects, and I got to see all of the different suit designs way up close. And the level of detail that the guys from Legacy put into this thing, and just for point of reference, these are the guys that built the Iron Man suits, right? So they have a tremendous amount of intellectual understanding of how to clothe people in armor in ways where the actors don't like start to freak out after a couple of hours, and keep them light, keep them easy to make. The Russian suits, I don't know if you remember in the film, this thing comes down.
Yeah.
So the actors, there were two helmets, one that actively moved on, and then as soon as that shot was done, they gave the actors actual video goggles so they could see what was going on. at Comic-Con, I ran into the guy that played Charlie's brother in the opening scene, the one who gets plucked out.
Uh-huh.
And he was telling me that that gimbal rig that they were riding on,
and all of the
practical that
the video was on the site.
excuse me.
They did.
He told me that gimbal that they were riding on was an absolutely terrifying ride and super fun for an actor.
I have to imagine you were in there just flailing around
Your feet are bolted into this elliptical machine, right? And then your arms are bolted to these things that look like they're helping you move, but they're just allowing you full motion. He said the guys playing in the Russian ship that got flooded with water were just beat to hell. I mean, the actors had so much fun in it.
The scene when the Russian Jaeger dies was one of the more intense. Like, we knew nothing about the characters, had seen them for maybe 25, 30 seconds at that point on screen.
They were go ahead.
They're the only people without full masks. The thing's filling with water. You're like, oh, this isn't the way you want to go. They have an eject button, right? Not so much, it turns out. Yeah.
And with that scene, the music was great because you had this really cool theme. The soundtrack is really good if you haven't listened to it. The theme of the
soundtrack just makes me want to go back and watch the movie again, oh, like I two or three more times
that today. Yeah. That's what I'm going to do in Red.
We'll make time for IMAX later.
With the credit sequence, that is like one theme that's every time they get into a good fight.
Right.
But when they transition to the Russians, it changed like a more Russian anthem theme. So yeah. Like they really personalize that.
I also loved the fact that most of the master shots felt. You know how when you look at Star Wars and then you go look at the Ralph McQuarrie drawings, you can see where they started and where they ended, right? And actually, I think that the advent of CG, one of the things that we have benefited from, and if you look at the difference between Episode 1 Star Wars and Episode 2, Episode 2 is not much better, but visually it's stunning. Mm-hmm. Like I defend that Episode 2 is gorgeous if you watch it with the sound off. And it's stunning because the master shots all really do look like production paintings, where it's not too much going on in each frame. Your eye is going where it needs to go, but there's a huge amount of detail. And Pacific Rim, man, every master shot feels like a beautiful production painting. Tokyo in the distance, the monsters, the water, the rain.
Oh, even the sets. The sets are decorated so nicely. You can tell. One of the things that I love about a movie like that is that, and this is something that was lacking in Prometheus, is when you're in a different person's cabin, you know whose cabin you're in based on the effects in the room. And it's something I didn't really appreciate until we started talking to you about movies. And it's kind of shifted the way I watch movies. Like, I was watching Pacific Rim during the flashback scene where Mako meets Idris Elba. I'm looking at the coat on those close-ups, and there's just this gorgeous cross stitch on the edge of the blue coat.
Right.
I was like, this is very, very clearly a young girl's coat in Japan.
That girl. So actually, we should call out that sequence. Yeah. And again, spoiler alert on this, but the scene where you see Mako as a little girl is one of the most beautiful scenes I've seen in the middle of an action movie ever. It feels right out of
people
a comic
book. People were crying.
Book. It's brutal and incredible, and that little girl's performance is shocking. I mean, of course, leave it to Guillermo to get a great performance out of a little girl, right? Like from Pan's Labyrinth.
He has a history.
It is that scene really sets the tone for, I think, just what I love about that movie. It's a beautiful, beautiful scene.
And in her turn, when she sees Idris Elba climb out of that helmet and there's the radiant light behind him, it's that hero scene. Yeah.
We were watching it. My wife was sitting next to me, and as the girl like holds up her hand, my wife is like, she knew. She's like, sort of punched me in the arm. She's like, I know it's coming. This is great. Love it.
What was your favorite robot? Design-wise.
Design-wise, I really liked the Japanese robot. I love the three arms. I love
the Chinese robot.
Jeez, Adam.
Sorry. I have to say, my favorite exosuits, though, are the white ones.
The white ones are gorgeous.
And the fact that the water filling up.
Yeah, that was neat. The double visor. I love that bit. The weird yellow water coming down.
Was it supposed to be some sort of like, it doesn't even matter. It just
I have
cool.
no idea.
Yeah. I got to see the black armor on the floor at Comic-Con. It was in the corner of the Legacy booth. And I mean, it's just up close. Like, a lot of times you see the actual props and they don't hold up. And that stuff is so gorgeous.
No. Those guys, again, we spent some time with the guys from Legacy at Comic-Con because they built that robot for Wired. The detail work that they do, that they put in, that you can't even see, but it really lends out of the corner of your eye just all this perfect industrial veracity to it.
Well, and the thing that they said in the video with the robot will be up probably later this week, I would think, maybe next week. I can't remember when we have it on the schedule. But their goal is to make it real, make something that would work if it were real, even if it's a giant robot with a dude inside. So, it's pretty amazing. The movie, you should go see the movie. Don't go in. Don't expect. You're not going to see. It's not the Citizen Kane.
It's not War and Peace.
It's not War and Peace. It's not
a genre movie, and it is. It's exactly what I said in that review. It is the ultimate rendition of what 12-year-old you wanted during Monster Week.
And the thing that I came out of thinking was, oh, this is the Crouching Tiger of monster movies, right?
Right.
Because
do you remember in the original? It's funny. I was thinking about this. Sorry. Go ahead.
No. That's it. That was it.
The scene with Mako as a young girl just occurs to me. Reminds me distinctly of that scene in the original Godzilla, the Japanese version, not the American version, with Ray Milland.
I'm not a monster.
Who it is? Yeah. edited into the Japanese version of Godzilla. But there's a scene in which Godzilla trashes a house and these kids come home and they're like, Mom, Dad, Mom, oh, Dad. And wow. I just remember watching that as a kid being like, that is messed up.
I'm so scared.
Yeah.
That's interesting because the Godzilla stuff was so much of a post-World War II, not to get like intellectual and stuff, but the symbolism.
Criticism.
And destruction,
post-nuclear world,
nuclear war,
and
evokes all that stuff, but is celebrated now, and we have all this, you know, like 9/11 imagery, like when we talk about Superman,
yeah, the Man of Steel,
and a lot, like, you know, you can't do a city destruction movie without evoking 9/11, but the reaction here is very different than, you know, I wonder if in Japan the Godzilla movies were received in the same way, like, you know, these people shouldn't be making these movies because it's too much, like, you know, well, it brings back too many bad memories about you know, the Holocaust.
Yeah. Pacific Rim, most of the destruction. This is if I had one complaint about the fights in Pacific Rim, it's that most of them happen at dark in like bays in the rain.
Yeah.
And
I presume that's because of this, it's easier to do CG.
I have no idea. Yeah, it's a good question.
But there's not a whole lot of actual city destruction. It's it's kind of like a side thing.
And you got there's a line, evacuate the city.
Right, so they're all plot points.
Reasonably assured that the city is relatively empty except for when Charlie's running from the...
And it's like this idea of like, you know, here's our safe zones. And just like the wall, it's a false sense of security.
Uh-huh.
But it's done in a very satirical way.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
The evacuate the city, just to be clear, completely impossible.
Of course.
Like, yeah, if you want to talk about city evacuation, go look at at New Orleans pre-Katrina and the line of traffic 400 miles long.
Was it really that long?
It was like a traffic jam from New Orleans to Houston, basically. So
the president's given the order. Evacuate the city.
Right. Well, an hour later, let's trash it.
What's his name?
And like in The Walking Dead, only one side of the highway is packed, and the other side is completely clear.
Right, right, yeah. Right.
No, that's not how it would work.
Yeah,
all four lanes, baby. Charlie Day. I know you didn't like the scientist too much, Norm. I loved the comic relief. Usually, the comic relief falls flat. I love the scientist, the Torchwood guy. I can't remember what his name is.
Right. The British guy.
And then what's his name? Hellboy.
Ron Perlman.
Ron Perlman. Thank you.
Ron Perlman. He's the muse. He has to be so good.
So good.
At the premiere, he got a very grateful round of applause. Everyone was like, "Oh, Ron's here! It's awesome."
Oh, and well, yeah, and then the post credit thing was, "Where's my other shoe?" It's so good. So good. So dumb.
And what I hope is that people, if they watch Pacific Rim and like it, they go back and watch Hellboy again and. Hellboy 1 and 2.
You know, it's funny because film critics, when they start talking about it, they always bring up Pan's Labyrinth. They say, Guillermo del Toro directed Pan's Labyrinth. And then they say, and the Hellboy movies. And then I've heard at least three different critics go, which are really much better than you think they are, if you should go back and take a look at them. Which is, I mean, I love Hellboy. I love the Hellboy movies. It's absolute, unadulterated affection for those movies.
I guess that's it.
This has been our half hour total rave about Pacific Rim.
Subscribe to our podcast.
Yeah, we're on iTunes. Leave us a comment. Like the video on YouTube. We read all the feedback. Pacific Rim's pretty awesome. You should see it in IMAX. I'm going to go to Petaluma and see it in D-Box this weekend, I think.
What's D-Box?
D-Box is where the seats move.
What?
There's a subwoofer in the seats, and they're all on little actuators, and they kind of...
and it's programmed, so someone watches the movie, and so for a movie like Fast Furious or Fast Five, it's moving as
you lean.
Yeah. No way! This is like the Tingler.
I think it's a little different than the Tingler. I think the D-Box guys might be, you know... I think they would probably disagree with it's like the Tingler, but yes, it's like the Tingler.
Maybe we should do a post where we explain the lineage of the Tingler, which is the natural precursor to the D-Box.
It's on the site.
Oh, it is? Okay, good.
Yeah. I think we should just go to the D-Box theater at like 8 o'clock in the morning and, you know, record from the D-Box theater.
Amazing. Yes. That's great. They're not everywhere. Let me know how that is.
Yeah, apparently it's not like the whole theater is D-Box. It's just like a row or two of seats in there are D-Box.
Those people are having a lot more fun than us.
You know, when I worked in a movie theater, one of the movies we showed for a few weeks was House, which is with William Katz, the horror film. And when there's a couple of big jump scares in the film, and the staff would just, for films like that, we'd gather at the back row of the theater and prep for a jump scare. And as soon as the jump happened, we'd all go, bah! And we'd like yell and just to add a third dimension to the audience's enjoyment.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
That's great. So yeah, that's it for the show this week. We'll see you guys next week.
See you next week.
Next Tuesday with another episode of Still Untitled. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.